The Beer EDU Podcast, Episode 124, Self-Directed Schooling with Greg Mullen. Welcome to the Beer EDU Podcast, the podcast for educators that love to learn and share ideas with fellow educators over beers, with your hosts, Kyle Anderson and Ben Dixon.
Kyle, my friend, how are you?
Ben, I am doing awesome. How about you?
I am good. And this is another episode of the Beer EDU Pod, episode 124.
124. Yes, indeed. And introductions first, I guess we'll go with. So I am Kyle Anderson. You can find me on Twitter at Anderson EdTech. Same thing with Instagram. And then also on Untappd at Anderson EdTech. And then I have a blog, AndersonEdTech.net, that I have been more active on lately. I have started to write a little bit more again. And then I'm also the author of To the Edge, Successes and Failures Through Risk-Taking, available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and also through my publisher, EduMatch Publishing. And you, my friend, you are?
Ben Dixon. I am from Reno, Nevada, and I can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and my Untappd at BDixonEdTech. I have a blog, and once upon a time I wrote on it, but not anymore. I really should. I put something on there, and I haven't in a long time. But anyways, yeah, that's time for another story. But if this is the Beer EDU Pod, before we introduce our guest, we might need to talk about what you are drinking, my friend.
Yes, indeed. That's what we do on this show. So I have some more of my beer from Michigan that my parents brought me. I love my parents for many reasons, but I especially love them that they brought me beer from my hometown, stocked me up for a while. So today I have Austin Brothers Beer Company's Northern Lights Lime. So this is Northern Lights is their just standard blonde ale. This one is a little bit different, A, because of the lime that's added to it. But this one is also a gluten-free version. So it's gluten-free. And then for a 12-ounce serving of it, so I've got the tall boy can, so it's a little bit more. Nice. But 95 calories, 2.4 carbs in 12 ounces. So these are ones that if you're trying to cut back on the amount of calories you take in from drinking, you could put down a few of these and be okay. Very smooth, very refreshing, hints of lime. This is the quintessential lawnmower beer. So 9,500 degrees and you got to mow the lawn, you could suck back a couple of these and be in pretty good, decent shape.
We might need to change that since as we're recording this, when we finish, you have hockey. So maybe it's a hockey beer. It's a pre-hockey beer.
This could be a pre-hockey beer. So, I don't tend to like to do heavy-duty beers before playing hockey. So, yeah, this could be a hockey beer as well. So save the heavy-duty ones for afterward. Like the heavy-duty one like you have. Yeah. Yours is a little bit heavy.
So I went with Revision, local brewer here in the Reno Sparks area. I went with the Nelson Revenge double IPA. So it's a 9% ABV. So clearly more than yours, 65 IBUs. Nelson Sauvin hops from New Zealand is what they use in this one. So it's a double IPA and everybody knows that's my go-to IPA. So yeah, it's a solid drinking beer, not a lawnmower beer.
Not a lawnmower beer. No, that one is going to put a little fur on your tongue on the finish, I bet. So, but as we're recording this, we're about a week away from you and I actually being able to see each other in person. We're going to be able to meet up because I'm going to be going up to Reno over my spring break. So there will be our next episode will be Ben and I together for the first time in over 2 years.
I think I might find a great place for us to go and record.
Yeah, well, don't tell me. I want to be surprised by this myself, so our listeners will be surprised as well.
Yep.
So, and before we introduce our guest, because we always do record these live, that gives you the opportunity on Facebook or YouTube to chime in. Yes. And Marissa Thompson is here. So, hello, Marissa.
Nice.
And she saw who our guest is and is very excited. She wrote in all caps this person's name. So, without further ado, I'm just going to go ahead and introduce Greg Mullen as our guest today. So, Greg, how's it going, my man?
What's up, Kyle and Ben? It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, we're stoked to have you straight from SoCal. You have a great beer. We were talking about it before the show. So, Greg, what are you drinking?
Dude, I got a nice, easy, smooth California honey blonde ale. I'm taking it easy from Pizza Port Brewery in Carlsbad. And, you know, nice. Keeping it California. I like to go there local. There's another local brew that I'm sporting here on video, Brew Yard from Glendale, my other favorite, that our good friends own it. They brew it. It's all natural. It's all awesome. They have a really good selection, but they're up in Glendale. So that's a bit of a drive for me. So I, you know.
We were talking about that before the show, the fact that, like, maybe if you have to drive 15 miles in a normal town like my town, I might complain that it might take me 10 minutes or 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's going to take you how long?
Oh, 45 on a Sunday morning.
Ooh.
Hour 15 in rush hour. Easy, easy. Ooh. And so I limit it. So I got this delicious selection of Pizza Port at my local grocery store. They got a couple of them. And so whenever I need some really tasty brew, I go down to the corner, had a hard day. I go down to the corner market. I pick up some port and I'm styling.
Right on.
Love it. Love it. And you know what else I love is not only Marissa Thompson jumped on the Facebook to say that she was excited about our guest, but she actually texted me and said that, Greg, you and her actually grew up together. So there is a Beer EDU connection here that was not planned at all. That is awesome.
Yo. Marissa Thompson, not just an absolutely stunning educator and leader in education, but yeah, a Torrance local just like me. And it's really cool to hear her name right now. That's awesome.
That's outstanding. Yeah, that's and then, you know, she just popped on with the comment here. She's sending the light hearts our way too. So God, no, that's a small world right there. I absolutely love it. So
nice.
Hey, you guys got listeners, man. Tell you that. Yeah.
So, well, thank you once again for joining us. So we need to know about you, though. I want to learn all about who you are. What do you do? What makes you tick? What are you passionate about? Let's hear the Greg Mullen story.
Oh, yep. Greg Mullen story. The History of My Skin by Greg Mullen. No, besides, you know, I got the heavy metal band. I do outdoor tactical laser tag. I do... you know, I write music. I go out there. I'm by the beach. I still got my 6'1" surfboard that I go out there and not as much as I like to. Admittedly, I should go out more, especially now that it's hot. Like, there's no excuse.
Yeah.
But other than, you know, all of those hobbies and things that keep me going, the other half that really drives me is education. And so for me, it's this whole concept of self-directed schooling. And so when I say self-directed schooling, the thing that really makes it interesting and drives me is this seemingly contradictory dichotomy of self-directed, which is, you know, a student directing their own education, having the authority, the autonomy, the self-determination, but in a schooling environment where you do have groups of students in classrooms and you do have a teacher in there that's kind of responsible for the health and safety of the kids. But the distinction there is the teacher doesn't have absolute authority over their learning. That's where the conversation begins, because what does that mean, right? So that's usually how I get the conversation going with people about what I do now as a consultant that I learned from the last 10 years of teaching in third, fifth, and seventh grade classrooms.
So, okay. So you were a classroom teacher, and I'm assuming a traditional school. I have so many questions about this. So I'm super curious about, like, how did you go, like, how'd you get from point A to this? Because this is, I mean, it sounds similar to competency-based learning. It sounds similar to PBL, but yet different. So yeah, walk us through that transition.
Well, I'm a big fan of standards-based grading. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of social-emotional learning. And I'm a big fan of what I call a developmental mindset, which takes into consideration each individual student's cognitive and psychosocial development, all of that stuff, right? I usually don't get too deep into that stuff. That's just there. But if you focus on the standards-based grading and the social-emotional learning, the more you learn about those two concepts and blend them, what comes out is a self-directed environment. And so the next question I usually get is, well, what do you mean? What does that look like? How do you do that? And so, like, you're asking, like, how do you go from a traditional classroom to this clearly contradictory kind of concept? And it's exactly my experience being in traditional classrooms that led me to this realization that when a student doesn't want to learn, it's not because of anything I'm doing. It's not because of anything that they're not doing. It really comes down to the relationships, the balance of authority, the balance of responsibility, and the students being shown not just what they need to learn, but learning how to learn, that really defines this evolution that I found myself going under and exploring. And so for me, being a traditional teacher, the biggest challenges I had with students really boiled down to, and I spent a long time figuring this out, boiled down to the fact that when I'm working with a student and they're having a hard time, they want to learn. The only reason they don't want to learn is when they feel bad because of things that I'm doing that make them feel bad, but they want to learn. So looking at what it is that I'm doing that makes them feel bad led me to understand why standards-based grading is so important as a principle, and why social-emotional learning competencies are so important for teachers to instill so that they can model and transfer that to their students. And between those two concepts, you can get a self-directed learning environment, even in a traditional schooling like institution, which I've done many, many years, even as early as third grade, but also in middle schools. And so so that's like how I got to that point. Well, that's a longer story, but that's kind of the overarching conceptual understanding of how I got from being a traditional school teacher, understanding standards-based grading, social-emotional learning, and getting to this point of blending them to create something new. And I don't know what grades you guys taught. We haven't talked about that. I'm curious what grades you teach as teachers and what teachers you know who might be familiar with standards-based grading and social-emotional learning and how they feel about those concepts. Because I know I get a lot of pushback still.
Oh, let me go, Kyle, please.
Yes, you go. Go ahead.
Because literally right now, so I am currently an elementary school principal, pre-K-5. Okay. It's report card time. I read every kid's report card. I'm just going to say this might go out there. The current grading system is dumb. Okay. I, as a classroom teacher, I was at two different schools where we did standards-based grading. It makes perfect sense. I've been a kindergarten all the way through sixth grade classroom teacher. I served as an instructional coach where we trained our district on the current standards, Nevada academic content, whatever you want to call them, the Common Core standards, whatever. But it makes so much more sense as I'm sitting with teachers and I'm having a discussion with in my district where kids in kindergarten use a portfolio. Perfect. First and second use this weird I improvement needed, S satisfactory, S plus, whatever. And then we jump to third. So parents' minds explode when they get to third grade and they go, what is a C when my kid was an S? And I'm like, okay, we have to explain. Yeah. So you had me right there. I'm like, my head was like, oh my God, this is the thing we need to be talking about.
Our people. Yeah. Yeah. We're out here. Yeah. We're out there doing this. There are more of us.
Right. Well, my district is, we are currently having a huge discussion, props to my district leadership and a bunch of our principals. We're talking about equitable grading practices. And this is on the table. I think this is such a huge part. So, that's my thing. Kyle, sorry. I had to interrupt you. I was like, I have to talk. My head's going to explode.
No, the look in your eyes, I could see it on the screen.
I was like, I totally, this is the gap.
Yeah. So now for me, I am a special education teacher. I've spent 98% of my career in the high school environment. I was, for a short time, I was a middle school administrator, but other than that, it's been high school the whole time. And we have just your traditional A through F scale where I'm at. the thing that I have always struggled to understand is that I grew up in schools in Michigan where it was a 4.0 grading scale. You could not get higher than a 4.0. And then I moved to Las Vegas and all of a sudden I'm hearing about kids that have a 4.8 GPA, because if you take AP or honors classes, there's this bonus aspect that gets added into the GPA. And then all of a sudden you're talking about the valedictorian has a 4.9 or something like that, which even now, 17 years later, I still cannot wrap my head around it. What class constitute as AP honors? Well, I mean, obviously by the name, but like, why does that class get bonus points versus just a standard class? Or for the students with an IEP that are in resource classes, why are they essentially getting punished on their GPA for the
right
class that they're taking, because it's not one of those bonus classes or whatever you want to say? The other thing that in my district right now, that I, as soon as they announced it was going to happen, I was very apprehensive about it. And there's a conversation for another day about grades in general and like assigning A through F and whatever, but
this is a whole other show, dude. We can do 2 hours just on that.
But what our district decided to do this year, after the last 2 years of just the, you know what show that we have all experienced, whatever, was so many kids failed. We need to give them a chance. So the lowest a kid can get is a 50% in any class at any given moment on any assignment. So a minimum F policy. And I liken the minimum F policy to the idea of communism. Communism on paper is the perfect society. You will never have a more perfect way to live because everybody's equal. Everybody's going to have everything they need, so on and so forth. A minimum F is on paper perfect because if a kid ends up missing 3 weeks, it's not going to kill their grade. It's not going to destroy them to where they can't earn credit for the rest of the semester. In reality, though, we watched communism around the world fail. And in the couple places that still exist, it is a complete failure. And those countries just have not realized it yet. They're still holding on.
Can I jump in?
I.e. your North Koreas. But with the minimum F policy, in my opinion, what it's doing is it has lowered the standards. It has not raised the bar for kids. To me, it has lowered the standard now to where a kid realizes that, oh, I don't have to do anything now, but I can still potentially pass without having to do anything. And I've seen students that had the capability of doing very, very well, but now do not apply themselves. And I partially blame it on this minimum F policy. But I'm curious to hear what you have to say, Greg, too, because you have something, I'm sure.
You guys touched on a number of things that I knew I should have brought a pad and pencil to take notes.
That's my game. I'm stealing all these ideas.
Right? But as far as the 50%, you probably heard conversations about the zero trench, or the whole thing where a zero, you can't recover from a zero. The moment you get a zero, you're done. You're done. Even if you learn everything that you're supposed to learn, that zero is going to most likely keep you from getting the 100% that you deserve for mastering all of the content because averaging.
Right.
And so setting everything so that an F, the traditional F, can't be lower than a 50 literally solves that trench problem by making sure that the lowest point they get is an F, or is a 50, not a zero. And a 50 you can come back from much, much easier, statistically significantly easier,
for sure,
than a zero or two that can't be removed for whatever silly reason a school makes up. And so you're basically just leading this kid down a path to failure that they can't get out of. And what does that do to the intrinsic value of learning when the reward that they're promised cannot be attained? And right. so, um, So that's where I like to go with that 50% or the 50 points or 50%, whatever. I'm a big fan of that for schools that want to adopt that. Right. But for those that are interested in a standards-based approach, that's still on this side of the conversation. You're still addressing a fundamental structural problem with grading that that is looking at points as extrinsic rewards for what should be an intrinsically intrinsic determinant for motivating students to want to learn how to learn regardless of the content. And that's where that leap from recognizing and having conversations about how to fix problems with points, you have to take a leap. There is a book by Lord help me. I got a library here, but he says there is a gap between traditional grading and standards-based grading, that if you try and have one foot in one world and one foot in the other, you're going to fall into this gap. That at some point, you have to leave the points behind. You have to leave the percentages behind. And any system that gets interpreted by percentages is inherently a traditional percentage-based grading system and therefore not a standards-based, proficiency-based model. So you have to take this leap away from points and percentages, and you have to begin exploring. And this is a multi-year process. Every book I have on standards-based grading says this, that it takes several years to first explore, then internalize, then pilot, and reflect, and then consider implementing. And so, because you're not just taking points and replacing it with something else that you're then going to interpret as a percentage-based letter grade system. You're taking the point system for rewards for what you're basically promising students to do work. I actually have a podcast episode on my Exploring the Core podcast where I get into points as a currency that we're promising students for if they do this much work to answer this question, we're going to give them this this denomination of currency, you know, an A. But what happens is, if I can just boil that episode down into a statement, you ask a student, like I'll ask a student to explain with rationale and evidence and reasoning about a topic, a concept, some kind of practice or concept, an idea or a skill. And that is essentially asking them to pay $3 for what they are used to paying $1 for. They are used to just going to the dollar store and getting that chocolate bar, that crunch bar. But now they come into your store and you're saying, no, no, no. That value of your work, no. That costs $3. I don't just want you to remember something. I don't want basic recall. I don't even want a depth of knowledge level 2, just a retelling in your own words of what it is that I taught you. I want you to come at me with a depth of knowledge level 3 with strategic reasoning and evidence. That's a $3 price tag on that $1 basic recall that they're used to. And that just messes them up. And so, you know, these conversations, they get really detailed. They get really in the weeds with metaphors and ideas when you're talking about points. You notice I mentioned DOK. DOK is the concept that underlies any standard, in parentheses, you know, concept or skill. Any student that says, what do I need to do to get my score up? Well, you've done these things, but you haven't done these, you haven't shown proficiency in these concepts or skills. So we need you to reach this depth of knowledge for this skill, this depth of knowledge for that skill. And if you don't know how to do that, we're going to teach you how to meet that depth of knowledge. We're going to teach you how to explain a concept with reasoning and rationale. But I'm not going to just sit here and instruct you on the content and expect you to repeat it back to me, because that's a DOK one. And getting them to understand that allows them to get away from how many points is this worth and take that leap as students. And again, teachers have to internalize this before they can do it. Really understand that to get credit for this, they have to meet a certain level of proficiency that's specific to the concept of skill in that standard. So I don't know if the examples I'm giving and the metaphors and all of this leaping stuff, first of all, makes sense, or if it's anything that you've noticed or heard in your experience.
No, I think, and I like thinking about what you said, Greg, makes perfect sense, because when you think about assessment, and so I spend a lot of time talking with my teachers about common assessments, what are we doing? What you're describing is in a traditional grading system or whatever, our assessments, even though we want to get to that DOK 4, because we're assigning a letter grade, it just becomes, those are the assessments. If you, okay, so a perfect example is we're taking state tests. We're using a Smarter Balance. I at one point worked for the company and I did item review. So I understand the depth of what kids are asked to do in a performance task. A performance task, if we were to give that to a student, that requires them to demonstrate a deeper understanding of the standard, explain their thinking, connect it to other standards, that's such a meaty assessment that to assign it an A, and then I turn around and go, here's a multiple choice test. You get an A on that too. You can't do that. I see your point of with the standards-based grading, when a child is a, let's just say a 4, shows deeper understanding of the standard, that means they've applied them in multiple ways. I mean, that's always been my experience, especially as a classroom teacher using standards. And I taught in a standards-based grading for 5 years, and then I left to take a district position. But they still, at the school I was at, they still use it. So I don't know. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, am I on the right path, like with assessment?
Yes, and it's a conversation I've had so many times that I've given talks on this, on DOK-4 specifically. It is a very specific part of a larger presentation that I give on implementing standards-based grading, because DOK-4 always seems like the goal, the dream, the target. Right. Like, if you're not a DOK-4, then you haven't mastered it. So,
but there's more.
There's more. There's so much more. There's always more. So lifelong learner, right? All of us. So here's the thing about DOK-4. DOK-4 is extended thinking versus DOK-3. If you compare that to DOK-3, which is strategic reasoning and evidence, what is it that you need from your students? Do you need them to give strategic reasoning and evidence for the concept or skill in the standard? Or are you truly requiring them to go beyond strategic reasoning and evidence with the learning materials that you've presented to them, which would be DOK-4, which, if that's the goal for standards that you're telling kids, no, you need to go to DOK-4. Then you're telling them that they have to not only get to a level of proficiency that requires them to strategically reason through the concept or skill and give evidence, given the materials that you've handed them, but then go out and find more materials and apply it in new novel ways that synthesizes and evaluates beyond the materials that you've handed them, extending the thinking beyond just strategically reasoning and think and giving evidence for, then suddenly you've set the bar higher than the standards require. Now I've had conversations with Dr. Karen Hess out of Vermont. In fact, when I was creating this app. Sorry, sidebar. I created this app.
My side hustle.
Yo, teachers have that. Teachers have them. And so, sadly. But this one's actually, I think this one's pretty cool. Because I have this this app that I created back in 2016 called Exploring the Core Math K-8. And there's a language arts one, but, you know. And it literally takes the math standards that from grade to grade, if you've ever looked at the Common Core State Standards across grade levels, they make no sense across grade levels. Like kindergarten operations and algebraic thinking one doesn't match third grade operations and algebraic thinking one. Those are two completely different skills.
Not only do they not match, but then when you get into the high school, because as a special ed teacher, when I'm writing goals, I do a lot of my goal writing based off of the Common Core. And the standards are the exact same for a ninth grader as they are for a 12th grader when it comes to different things. So that's frustrating as well. So I end up having to do a little bit of modification on my own when I come to writing goals because Common Core does not make sense.
Now, I figured that out during my teaching. I was about halfway through my teaching career to this point and to today. And I figured out, like, when I sat there and I typed out all the math standards into a spreadsheet and I started clicking and dragging around and I ended up lining them up. And some skills start in some grade levels and end in other grade levels. And so I just sort of lined them all up and I ended up with this huge spreadsheet that when I printed it out at Kinko's, what it basically was an entire wall of rows and columns. And my wife was concerned, but I told her, don't worry. I know what I'm doing. You know, I'm figuring it out. But what was fascinating was I looked at it. And I'm like, people need to know how these skills connect across grade levels, but I can't give them a wall of words. And so I said, well, what if I created just the rows to show how skills go across. And so I did that and I illustrated each grade level skill across, right? And then I was like, well, I can't have teachers walking around with these cards, these boxes of cards. So I'm like, all right, this is nuts. There's gotta be a way. So yada, yada, yada. I ended up hiring a friend of mine from high school that is now an app developer, who's a software engineer. And so he developed an app that that's now on the App Store and Google Play and all that, that literally illustrates, and you can swipe across the grade level standards in Common Core to see how the math skills align across grade levels. So when I sat down with parents and I said, look, your seventh grader, like, this is what your teacher's expecting of them, or this is what I'm expecting. But I figured, I was able to figure out that that skill, they're having a hard time because back in fourth grade, they didn't get this. They got this in third grade.
Right.
And then I would just swipe the screen. And I said, at some point, they didn't get this. And then I swiped the screen. And then fifth grade, that was impossible. And then I swiped the screen. And in sixth grade, they saw, like, well, this suddenly jumps into a whole new world of learning. Right. And it's like, and I said, yes, exactly. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to design an intervention approach that's going to meet them exactly where they're at according to the Common Core State Standards, which are essentially a roadmap for skills to develop in and across grade levels. And so when you look at the standards, and this is an activity I have in my presentation where I have the teachers in the room look at an anchor standard in language arts because those are easier.
Yes. I was just going to say, because ELA is way different than math.
Exactly. They're actually designed that way already. Yes. Brilliant. And so I give them one anchor standard from kindergarten to eighth grade, and I say, tell me when the standard gets to, tell me what grade level requires level four knowledge, right? And so I set them up. Obviously, I know that no standard actually gets to DOK-4.
Right.
Because the language always stops at DOK-3. The specific verbs and context that the verbs are used in stops at DOK-3. And so so the teachers end up like, well, wait a minute. You said which, you know, you set us up. I'm like, yes. And what did we learn?
Well, and I love that because it's something I've done similar with teachers. Is the beautiful thing about the ELA standards is like we used to have these books and we would cut the books up with the standards. And similar to where you lined them up, we lined them up vertically because what you can find is that the writing and the foundational skills, and then you get into informational text and narrative text, there is almost a progression this way that if you're doing these things in reading, you can apply them in writing, similar to that. And I think with ELA, as you look through the standards across the grade levels, I hate to say, and as an English major, and I hate saying this, but reading is reading is reading. It then becomes text dependent. It's like, what is the text I'm giving kids? So now are you applying like identifying main character and theme of book versus, you know, in a book like Hatchet, Gary Paulson book, or versus a kid, a second grader who's reading, you know, a transitional reader book. I'm like, I blanked out. My kids are old now. I don't have exposure to those books, but that's what, but math, I love that idea because I think we talk about that a lot in our school is like, when we look at a kid in an intervention and we say, this kid is struggling in this academic math area, you can just trace it back to like, hey, look, in second grade, this kid missed 45 days of school. That's a chunk of math. Like, what did that kid miss? And I think, I don't know if both of your experiences, I know Kyle, we've talked about this, the pandemic, oh man, we got kids that like, as soon as I see a kid where they'll say, this kid's really struggling, I'm all, let's see what that kid did last year. Because we'll go back and go, that kid was distance learning. And we're like, I don't know what he did. So, I mean, I think that's, are you seeing some of that too? Like Greg, in your work, like are people coming to you and being like, okay, what do we do now?
Yeah, I'm spending my time right now writing a second book, but I'm tutoring to kind of keep in touch with what kids are doing in classrooms. So I got, for example, I got this third grader, this adorable little third grader that, you know, for the last 2 years, she's been pandemic schooling, you know? And so first grade, second grade, and now she's in third grade. I know these standards in first and second grade. You know, I made an app about them. Sorry to plug that again. But I know what she missed. And I know that there are fundamental reading skills, foundational reading standards are literally what they're called that she missed or likely missed. And when I hear her read, I can see that. And so it really doesn't take much for me to kind of go and say, look, to the parent, these things, like it doesn't take long to realize these are the things that she missed. And it's not because she wasn't taught it. And it's not because she can't learn it. That's where she is. And if you remove these arbitrary grade level like expectations and you basically switch the lines so that they're not up and down, they're left and right. And you identify for this skill, they're here. Teach that and make that fun. They're going to get it. Or go back one step, teach that, get them excited, build their confidence, and then introduce the next thing. The problem becomes with all of this that we're talking about is that teachers have 20, 30, 40 kids in a classroom, and the teacher cannot take full authority and responsibility for individually instructing each and every one of those kids. And Kyle, in high school, I've taught at a K-12 school, and the high school teachers would always tell me, Greg, I love that you're able to do it in third and fifth grade. But, oh, honey, no. I got 100 kids just cycling through my room every day. I cannot do that. And the I try as hard as I can to get the point across. But you know, part of my research right now, I'm also working with a research team out of Utah Valley University on the trans-theoretical model for behavior change and metacognition. And so we're doing this big grant study right now. But it becomes an issue of, I can't do that. Well, no. Not with the teaching and learning model being applied in your classroom. No, you cannot take 100% authority and responsibility for every one of those students. The problem then becomes the students don't know how to take any percentage of that authority and responsibility because they have just had 9, 10, 11 years of never having it.
I agree with you on that because I co-teach. I have 200 students across my co-taught classes. Mm-hmm. That is in addition to the 27 students I have on my caseload, where there are days where, and I don't have my caseload students in my classes. So there are days where I could walk in with my co-teacher, like, today's going to be a great day. We're going to do this, this, and this. And then one of my caseload kids is in crisis mode, and I have to disappear for the next 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
So hold on, time out. Your caseload kids aren't in your co-taught classes?
I do not have my caseload kids. I have the same students on my caseload. The design
that
is
blew my mind.
The design is that I have the same kids on my caseload for their entire high school career, so I can get to know them as students. So I stick with the same subject, teacher, et cetera, those students, once I may have them as, I had several of them last year as freshmen. But this year, sophomores, I don't have them.
Wow.
So I believe I have a guidance class where I have three of my caseload students in that class. That's all I have. So now, but to really support this whole idea, and forgive me for oversimplification here, but I've been thinking about this now for the past almost 30 minutes of this just absolutely enlightening conversation. Real life does not assign grades. Okay. In real life, if there is going to be some sort of evaluation where your job depends on or whatever, it's going to be based on a standard. It's going to be on a standard. So the simplest way to do that right now is a teacher's evaluation. My teacher evaluation is based on a standard. 1 through 4 is what it's assigned through. And there's all these different indicators that evidence shows that I did this very, very well, but I did not do this part very, very well. In the end, the standards dictate whether I am highly effective, effective, I believe it's somewhat effective, or
developing,
not
developing. You're developing or
developing
you're
or not effective.
Or ineffective
or ineffective or something like that. So that's the standard. But then in real life, the only thing right now that I can think of that is grade-based, and to me is a bit of a failure, is think about the driving test at the DMV. You have to go to the DMV and you have to pass a test with an 80% or better. On that test, you have every opportunity ahead of time to study a booklet, go online, do whatever you got to do. There are going to be people that are absolutely horrific, terrible, irresponsible drivers that can go in and ace that test. But then there are people that are going to be the most responsible drivers on the road that are not going to be able to pass that test no matter how many times they take it.
Right. And but they also get to retake it a million times.
They do.
That's
but there's still going to be people that are not, they're going to fail that test over and over and over again. And that is not, it's not fair to those that, again, are the responsible ones. Because again, you have, take the streets of Las Vegas lately, they've been publishing just the sheer number of people that have been getting pulled over around here for going over 100 miles on the freeway. And there was an accident a while back where a man ran a red light going over 100 miles an hour and plowed into a handful of people and killed 9 people.
Sad.
And that person probably was the one that got 100% on the DMV test.
Right.
And that's appalling and disgusting and heartbreaking at the same time. So I apologize for that rant. It seems like an oversimplification, but that's really kind of what I was getting out of a lot of what we were talking about.
I appreciate you keeping it light. I think it was great. But the idea that
I was ready to totally nerd out, Greg. I was like, okay, we're going down my rabbit hole because this is my jam. And I'm like, we're gonna lose 90% of our audience because we're
well. Let me pitch this. There's a Facebook group that I fell in love in 2017 with. It's called Standards Based Grading. Right. And that's it.
Okay.
But Ken O'Connor is known as the grade doctor. And I've got two of his many books. He's one of the admins. Matt Townsley is another one who has a fantastic book on standards-based grading in high school. There are so many, like Fanny Passaport's on there. I think Marissa's in that group. But one of the things that always comes up when new people that are new to standards-based grading join this group and they're like, okay, but what about this? They get into this.
What about GPA?
Right. What about isms? And every single time, this example of the driving test comes up. And it's hysterical every single time because we get into this cycle where new people come in and we talk about this. And then new people come in, we talk about it again. And it always comes down to this idea that the driving test is always an example for policies on assessment retake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's a standards-based grading principle that you can take a test as many times as you like. And just like in the real world, you can take and fail a driving test. And there's no there's no shame beyond going home and having your parents just shake their head. But then, they say, well, study and take it again in 6 months. You have to wait 6 months. You have to study. You have to do the test again. You have to do the driving test again. There's a process. There's a procedure. But you can take it as many times as you like. And so when you apply that to a standards-based grading principle, a kid comes in, takes an Algebra 1 test on I don't know, the Pythagorean theorem. And they don't pass it. They bomb it. They clearly didn't study. Their answers don't make any sense. And so you hand it back and they're like, you didn't really study, did you? And they're like, no, but I wanted to see what the test was like. I get that. In 2 weeks, you can take another version of it. But if you don't pass that, you're going to have to wait another 2 weeks and take it again. But there are other things that you need to be doing as well. So yeah, you can take it as much as you want, but it's going to build up and that's the punishment. There's no shame in retaking the test as many times as you like. And you can even design an assessment system that requires a DOK 1 to access the DOK 3. That way you can automate the DOK 1 assessment because it's just basic recall. Then, only then that they have this basic recall of basic information, then you have to actually grade something that they do because then they've shown you that they're ready for the DOK 3. And if you design your assessment process that way and you focus it on what are called, strong standards? No. Staple standards? No. There's something...
Of course, essential standards or... I know what you're talking about.
You know which ones are most important for what's coming in the next grade level. Mm-hmm. And you know that there are other standards that might be finishing a skill progression.
Right.
There are standards that might be through progressions that they can sort of get to in the next year and go back and revisit. But you know that there are things that if they don't learn it now,
right,
in that year, there's like 50%, let's say for argument's sake, that they really have to get or they're going to struggle. And if they don't get those and they're socially promoted, then you're gonna need to tell that teacher so that they can set up an intervention and address that.
So Greg, in a true standards-based grading, like a true standards-based teaching and everything, would we really look at eliminating this idea of you're a first grader, you're a second grader, you're a third grader, and move into a system of like, these are core standard, essential standards you have to have. You may master them in a traditional year, and I might master them in a year and 6 months or 4 months.
The distinction is you're using a standards-based grading approach, but what you just referred to is a standards-based approach to a self-directed schooling environment.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. Okay.
That's where we get back to my whole reason for being right now, that I left the classroom to, espouse and preach to whoever wants to listen or not want to listen. I'll say it anyway. But it's why I wrote this book. And if I may shill another product.
Yes.
It's
shill away.
Why do we write books? But it's called Creating a Self-Directed Learning Environment. Corwin Press decided to publish this thing after I wrote it and sent it to them. Ken O'Connor kind of helped me out with that. Okay. Amazing human being. Matt Townsley also gave me some feedback on how to approach this whole process because I'm new to the book stuff. But it essentially breaks down the main parts of standards-based grading. It's not a standards-based grading book. There are lots of other experts that have more detailed books on standards-based grading because, like you're saying, standards-based grading, the principles and the tenets and the facets and all these things that we want to get across. Yeah, I mentioned that in the first chapter. But the second chapter is about social-emotional learning because if you're going to make these kinds of changes to how we do standards, how we do grading, how we do assessments, how we do reporting, how we do all of the feedback, you're going to need to address social competencies in how the students handle conflict, handle de-escalation, handle their emotions. Teachers need to know how words they're using to communicate their frustration. They need to understand the impact of that when you're asking them to basically change how they've learned, how students have learned their entire lives. Started in kinder. And it's going to be a lot smoother. That's always been my one critique of the standards-based grading. Common Core State Standards is they implemented at K-12 intended for collateral damage. And it's just heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah. No, I trained teachers the first year we had it. That was my job, is I traveled around and I worked with in my district, and I worked with about 25 schools. And it was like, okay, you're going to do this and it's going to overwhelm kids. And then they're going to move to the next level and it's going to overwhelm them. And we're like, okay, how many years now are we into this? We're kind of getting there now. I mean, that group of kindergartners now would probably be, you know, about high school kids now. And so yeah. Are they like, they are, so the question is like, where are they at? As opposed to like a current crop of like, I look at my fifth graders, this is all they know. So I we're going to run out of time and I have so many questions.
Yeah, I was going to get real wonky. So I'm glad you stopped.
if I'm a teacher and I'm just like super interested in this, I'm listening to this show, like, where do I start? Like, where would you recommend somebody kind of like, I'm in a traditional school and we do this. Like, how do I start?
Number one, you gotta start exploring standards-based grading, learning, assessments, and reporting. You just find a book. Go look up Matt Townsley. He has a collection of academic articles, university peer-reviewed articles on the effectiveness of standards-based grading practices. Standards-based has been around for 20 years, 30 years, since the 80s. There's references to standards-based approaches, but it's only just now that the movement is really gaining steam. And so look up Matt Townsley. Reach out to him. He's the nicest guy. He's in Cedar Falls, Iowa. and look up, he's got a website with books on standards-based grading, articles on standards-based grading, research for the administrators who are a little hesitant. You want to make sure that you understand the standards-based grading and reporting approach because you're probably already kind of looking into social and emotional learning. And if that's the case, once you start getting into standards-based grading, once you really dig into the social and emotional learning, and I'm happy to help make that connection between using standards-based grading to teach social emotional learning and merge those. But once you do those two things, once you get into those two things and start considering what happens when you blend those two for the cognitive and psychosocial developmental needs of the grade levels that you're teaching, right? There's that third thing that I said at the beginning of the episode, I'm probably not going to get into, but there's that third circle.
Right.
Those are the three circles of my model for self-directed schooling. And so someone that's kind of like, wait a minute, what'd you say? What do I need to do? Go out and find Matt Townsley. Go out and find Ken O'Connor. Go out and find what's her name? Doctor in Vermont. I mentioned her earlier.
Hess.
Yes, Karen Hess.
Yeah.
And join the Facebook group Standards-Based Grading. You know, I'm on there. I just posted something a few days ago, just for funsies, on extrinsic rewards in relation to standards-based grading. And a heated conversation on, on that. That was fun. So get in the mix, really start to explore it. And if you have questions and you want your school to kind of start exploring this, reach out to me, reach out to Ken, reach out to Matt, reach out to Karen, reach out to any of us, because we're not looking, like, our goal isn't to make a living doing this. Our goal is to have more schools doing it. And me personally,
so a couple things then.
Yeah,
couple things then. So first, how are people going to connect with you? Social media, different ways, websites, whatnot.
Yes.
And then second part, I'm kind of with Ben here. There's still questions that are unanswered. And the episode's getting a little long in the teeth. So would you want to come back and do a second episode at some point?
Yo, hit me up. And I'll actually bring Brewyard beer this next time.
Oh, no. And Kyle, we joke about this all the time, but I'm like, this show is really just a self-indulgent for me to steal ideas. And Greg, you are like, this was so timely because I have exactly been thinking about this. And I'm like, I would love to explore this further because I see this potential in what we could do. So yeah, how do people get in touch with you?
My consulting agency is just me and it's called Exploring the Core. And you can visit me on my website, exploringthecore.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Instagram, exploring_the_core. You can find me on Twitter, etc_app, because I created that when I made my app in 2016. you can find my book on just Google Greg Mullen, Self-Directed, and Corwin will pop up. You can check out my podcast, Exploring the Core Podcast. It's on most things. And I got 2 seasons, and each episode talks to a really cool expert in some topic related to standards-based social-emotional learning and human development. And so, where else can you find me? I'm really easy to find.
Outstanding. So we will definitely be in contact for another episode here in the coming weeks because, I think this is something that we could spend a lot of time exploring a little bit deeper. So thank you for your time tonight, but stick around because we do have more to the episode here. But first, listeners, we would love for you to keep this conversation going and share some of your thoughts on today's topic. You can do that by emailing us at info@beeredupodcast.com. Tweet us at beeredupod and use #beeredupod. Hit us up on our Facebook page at beeredupodcast. That's all one word. Follow us on Instagram at beeredupod. Our YouTube channel is bit.ly/beeredu YouTube. And then make sure you're hitting up Greg on all of those socials and his website so you can get in contact with him. Leave us a review wherever you listen so more can find the show. And Ben, if people want to be on the show like Greg, what do they have to do?
So go to our website, beeredupodcast.com. You click on that contact and subscription info link, complete the guest form, get in the queue. We want to talk to you about what you're passionate about. And I want to steal your ideas. Let's just be honest. So that's what I'm here for. So thank you so much, Greg. We also have to thank some other people, School Rubric, for featuring the Beer EDU podcast. The mission of School Rubric is to help schools, educators, parents, and students tell their stories so that stakeholders can make the best choices about enrollment and staffing. So go to schoolrubric.org, find more great content from educators around the world. And then we also are part of the Codebreaker Podcast Network. You can find the Beer EDU podcast there. You can also find so many other great podcasts. There's Teachers Talking Teaching, Student-Centered World, STEM Every Day, Teachers on Fire, My EdTech Life. Go to codebreakeredu.com. Check out all those amazing podcast. And this is the part, Greg, where we're going to talk about some more beer. Kyle, what do you got for us?
So last episode, when we had Kara Lee and and Lucy on the show, we talked a little bit about ginger beer. And I promised that I would do some research on ginger beer, and I am coming true to that promise right now, because that's what we are going to talk about right now. So,
all right.
Now, ginger beer is, I put in parentheses, usually a non-alcoholic drink traditionally made with ginger, yeast, and sugar. So the non-alcoholic versions, they don't use the yeast. So it's just basically ginger and sugar typically. So this is not to be confused with ginger ale, though. Ginger ale is typically a lot sweeter and not as gingery. And they oftentimes use fake ginger flavor in those. So like the typical one that you would see a lot of times is like your Canada Dry and your Schweppes. Those are ginger ales.
Oh, okay.
I'll get into some different versions of ginger beer and ginger ales. Ginger beer is bolder, it's spicier, and it's ginger flavor because they typically use real ginger in the brew. So now ginger has been around forever. And in China and India, millennia ago, it was a popular herb to use for medicine. It's been used for medicinal purposes. And even today, when I have an upset stomach, I get Werner's ginger ale and drink some of that to try to calm my stomach. Or if I don't have access to that, just a little bit of powdered ginger mixed into a glass of water, drink that. That typically will calm my stomach a little bit. So it's been used for medicine forever. When colonial trade routes opened in like the 1600s, 1700s, Europeans started to use it to spice up drinks and flavor drinks in Europe as well. So now ginger beer itself came about starting in Yorkshire, England in the mid-1700s. And then it kind of spread out from there through Ireland, eventually into Canada, the United States, South Africa, the UK. Really, so throughout the Commonwealth, ginger beer became very popular. So, but by the early 20th century, it kind of had faded in its popularity. So now, for the most part, though, ginger beer under British law cannot be more than 2% ABV. So there was a law passed in 1855 that said no more than 2%. However, most of them don't have any alcohol today. So now, how is this made? Alcoholic versions, they're brewed with water, ginger, yeast, and sugar. So kind of like a beer, except your flavoring's coming from ginger and not from hops. And then the sugar that's added is what you would normally get from, say, the barley in beer. Non-alcoholic versions, water, ginger, and sugar. And then rather than being fermented to carbonate it, they infuse it with carbon dioxide. So it's more of a modern day thing versus like just aging it and fermenting it like they used to do before you were able to infuse. So now while Kara Lee in our last episode, she was just drinking a straight bottle of it, which nothing wrong with that. I've done that before. It's good. It's mostly a cocktail mixer. So, and then ginger ale can be used for that as well. So popular alcoholic version is from Britain. There's Krabby's. So if you've ever had a Krabby's ginger beer, that's a real popular one. Kara Lee on our episode with her, she was drinking a Bundaberg, which is a common non-alcoholic version of it. But then you've also got the ginger ales again. So Canada Dry, Werner's are both real common ones. Werner's was huge in Michigan. It's a little harder to find out west, I still find it and buy it because, again, that's the cure for
that's
all. You got a cold, you got the flu, drink Werner's and you're good.
There it is.
So now you mentioned the Moscow Mule. Of course, that's a popular one. Vodka, ginger beer, and lime. So absolutely phenomenal drink, but even better than a Moscow Mule, especially right now. I'm kind of boycotting things Russia right now. Irish Mules. You take Jameson, Irish whiskey, ginger beer, and lime, and you've got pretty much the same thing. And they always do that.
How dare you defile a Jameson's? Just drink it straight. But that's just me.
Yeah. Well, you're Irish whiskey of choice. How heritage. About that? So, but you've also got, those are always drank in a copper mug too. And that's specifically because copper conducts the cold and it keeps the drink cold for longer. So, but here's one I never heard of. And this sounds delightful. It's called a Dark and Stormy. It's ginger beer and rum.
Yes.
Yep. I'm all for that. That sounds delightful. So, but I mean, you can mix ginger beer with just about anything, I'm sure. So you can really start going down some rabbit holes making stuff. So, but yeah, so that's, like I said, I promised ginger beer and there it is.
There it is, man. I think that might be a wrap. I think Greg, we didn't even get to talk about the band that he's in, so that's why we have to have him on the show.
That's why we got to have him back.
I'm super stoked because he has a bass right behind him, and I want to talk about music.
Yeah, so he's in a metal band, and me and Ben, you and I, we talk about the punk, but we are also into the metal as well. So.
Oh, of course we are. I love I'm rocking some Maiden on the way home today. So there we go.
So, well, listeners, thank you for joining us. Greg, thank you for joining
us. Yes, Greg.
Until next time, may the malts and the hops be with you.
Right on.
Right on.